Well, hello and welcome everybody to another month's Rowing Chat. This is the podcast with and for people who enjoy the sport of rowing. We've been broadcasting since February 2013, and this month I'm joined by Bill Manning. I'm Rebecca Caro. Bill, welcome to Rowing Chat.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here, Rebecca.
Now, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your history in the sport.
Well, I'm currently the assistant lightweight men's rowing coach at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey, in the States. And during the summer months, also coach with the United States Rowing Senior Men's National Team. Last year, I had the lightweight men's pair. The summer before that, the lightweight men's eight. I started rowing in school. And largely did so because I was a swimmer and a competitive water polo player, and so was sort of drawn to the water. Never particularly adept at field sports, and then continued rowing at university and did a little bit of rowing after college, not with much success at all. Got away from the sport and then sort of got back into it when I was teaching at a school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ended up doing some work with the junior national team for the US, and then volunteering at Harvard when I was in graduate school there, and ended up getting hired at Harvard and working with the heavyweight men and my mentor Harry Parker for about 15 years. And through that have been fortunate to be able to do a fair bit with international rowing with the US squad. And now here I am in Princeton, New Jersey, where the U.S. team is based, and at a great university and with great athletes and good kids.
Fantastic. Lucky you
Yes,
and lucky
very lucky.
US rowing.
Very lucky for me.
So right now you're coaching lightweights, and to date we've never had a podcast focusing on lightweights. So today you and I have agreed that that's what we'll focus on, but not exclusively. Let's kick off with a general question. What's your approach to coaching lightweight rowing?
I tend to think of it less as an approach to the discipline of lightweight rowing, and just more coaching individuals, working with individuals, and using the medium of rowing. So, whether someone's a lightweight, a heavyweight, whether they're a male or a female, whether they're a sweeper or a sculler, I don't think those are particularly strong differences in how you approach your coaching of those athletes. So. There are a few things you do differently with lightweights, for sure. You do have to weigh in. You do have to make sure everyone's at weight. If you're not at weight, you're not racing. And I do think lightweights have certain concerns that open weights tend not to have, in terms of both their weight management and developing strength and power. But really, it's essentially the same thing. You're still working with motivated athletes, capable athletes. Some just happen to be larger, and some happen to not be so large.
That's pretty nice. And from the athlete's point of view, how would I know as an athlete if I was a lightweight?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, and one that's difficult to answer satisfactorily. I think that a lot depends upon the age of the individual. I would maintain that youngsters, school age rowers, should not even let that question enter their mind. I think it would be a mistake. I do think it's a mistake to have weight-restricted rowing for youngsters. So, if you're still in school, enjoy the rowing. Aspire to be in the fastest boat within your program that you can. But don't worry about your weight. Develop your strength. Develop your fitness. Develop your skills. Your coachability. As you get older, as you get to be in your 20s, as you get into university or club rowing after school, then I think you can realistically start thinking about whether you're better suited for a weight-restricted category. And I would encourage people to just sort of look at where they're comfortable with their body weight. And if that body weight is one that is close to the weight requirements, then that's something that can be considered for sure. But I would not encourage someone to pursue lightweight rowing because they're not having success as an open weight. You know, pursue lightweight rowing because you see yourself competing with people that are your size, and that eliminates one of the variables in sport and allows for more competitive experience for you, not just search for greater success. Typically, I would say someone should be comfortably within 10% of the required weigh-in weight before they think about rowing lightweight.
And that's a really great answer, particularly from my own personal experience in having trained alongside people who are lightweights. Some of them have taken many years of rowing before they made the decision to lightweight. And my experience is that young athletes are usually in a hurry and they forget that rowing is an endurance sport and that it takes many years of training before you're successful. But more than that, a lot of people don't realize that their body is still maturing. They may not be physically growing.
Absolutely true.
You're still maturing through into your early 20s.
Yeah, absolutely true. And when you've passed through puberty, when you've entered adulthood and you sort of know where your body is, then you can make a decision about what's healthy and appropriate. But while you're still growing, absolutely, I would discourage anyone from doing anything that would attempt to influence their weight. Just be healthy. Be healthy, be fit, be strong. You can't go wrong doing that.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you do coach a few things a little bit differently from lightweight. Yeah. And so this is a question that's come in from Caitlin Reed, who's in Johannesburg at St. Mary's Rowing Club. She wants to know, do you coach the lightweight women in the same way you coach the lightweight men? And if not, what's the difference?
Well, the truth is that I've never actually been responsible for coaching women, lightweight women in particular. So I can't answer that question experientially. But if I was to, again, I would revert back to my feeling that you're really coaching the sport and coaching the individual. And certainly how I, as a middle-aged male, might interact with a younger female athlete versus a younger male athlete, there are going to be some differences for sure. But it's not that I'm going to treat the athlete differently because of their gender. You're just going to respect that there are differences between us and try to work with what the strength of the relationship can be. Typically, the athletes that I'm fortunate to work with are highly, highly motivated. And, there's really, I don't see a difference between how the women approach things and how the men approach things. I think that there is a different response sometimes to relating to authority figures of the opposite gender. And that's something that you would absolutely want to take into account. But you're going to teach the same rowing stroke. Human physiology is human physiology, regardless of one's gender. The mechanics of rowing, the physics of rowing, that doesn't change because it's a male or a female sitting in the boat. That's the same. And so I would emphasize the similarities. And I think most athletes want to be coached and want to be treated as an athlete, not as a male athlete, not as a female athlete, but as an athlete. If you can support them as an athlete, I don't think the gender matters. I don't think they're looking for anything too different because of their gender, whether they're male or female.
I certainly subscribe to that. And as someone who has coached a lot of women and a lot of women lightweights, for me, the number one difference between men and women is it's very much easier with men to challenge them emotionally by saying, was that your best performance? And to call them out on things when you think that they haven't yet got close to understanding their capabilities. Mm-hmm. And you have to be careful in your judgment when addressing it to women, because a response that I have seen happen is they burst into floods of tears and suddenly you've lost all authority and your ability to pursue your point, which is to get the athletes to work to find their own limits and to challenge themselves, has been undermined by an emotional response that takes quite a long time to mop up and get back.
Yeah, I think, if I can add, I do think the higher one is on the the ladder of excellence, the more similar the genders are, men and women do relate to one another differently, and they relate to a male authority figure differently. You've got to be cognizant of that, and you have to be sensitive to that. But certainly with the international caliber athletes that I'm around, at this level, the similarities far, far, far outweigh the differences.
And that's definitely something that we hear over and over again. Please treat everybody the same.
Treat everyone the same, as in care about each individual. You may end up, you may be treating people differently, but you're treating them differently because of who they are as an individual, not because of their gender.
Let's go back to what you do differently with lightweights. What are the two or three things that people should be aware of?
Well, we're right now with the university students, we're in our racing season, and March in this part of the country, the month of March is a transitional month, and it can be quite windy all up and down the east coast of the U.S. So one of the things that we do, that I do with the lightweights, is I'm just a little more careful about doing work into headwinds when the athletes are down at weight or near weight. I do think that the body is a little more susceptible to breaking down when they're close to their racing weight. So, if I was out there with a bunch of heavyweight guys, I might not worry too much about working them into the wind. Whereas right now, I might pass on doing that piece into the headwind and paddle up and do another piece in the tailwind. So that's one thing that's different. Obviously, in the off season, in terms of developing the power that's necessary for our sport, with the lightweights, we're really trying to develop the power without adding mass, without adding bulk. You've got to be careful with that particularly with the young guys. The young guys, every young male wants to be bigger. That's doesn't matter whether they're a heavyweight or a lightweight. I've sometimes said that the difference between boys and men is that the boys always want to be bigger, and men are always looking to try to shed a few pounds. So even though I'm coaching these university lightweights, they want to be big and strong, and we have to, in a sense, keep them on a bit of a leash and not let them turn themselves loose in the weight room, or they'll come out with all these beach muscles that will, in the end, be a hindrance to their rowing. Keeping an eye on how we do the weights and also what the individuals are doing. With the lightweights, I just think things like sleep and nutrition and all the boring but necessary pieces that go into taking care of oneself are of greater importance. The lightweights just have less of a margin for error. Your big heavyweights can sometimes get away with something that may be less optimal, and the same behavior would really set a lightweight back, perhaps. So, just trying to really drill in the fundamentals of taking care of themselves and getting the proper sleep and the proper nutrition, and if they're following a calorie restricted diet, making sure that those calories are getting into their body in a good way with good food.
One of the things that I often advise is that people keep a daily diary where they note how they feel when they wake up, how many hours sleep they had, and their hydration, for example, how many liters of water you drank a day. And in fact, I'll put a link in the show notes to a daily diary, which was given me by Harry Mann, the New Zealand coach.
That's anything from Harry Mann people should pay attention to. I'm going to throw that in right now.
Well, thank you for that. That's great. Now, earlier on, you mentioned coachability as an attribute that a good athlete has. How do you define it, and how does someone go about trying to acquire this for themselves?
Oh, boy. I define coachability as a willingness to take chances, a willingness to take risks. Most of the athletes that I work with have had previous athletic experience, and specifically rowing experience. So they've arrived either at the university or at the training center having enjoyed some success, some level of success in the sport. And they get here, and then we ask them to do things differently. We ask them to change their behavior. We ask them to change how they take the stroke. We ask them to adapt their training. And understandably, that's a scary thing for many people, because you're asking them to give up on methodologies and behaviors that have worked for them, that have yielded them success, to set those aside and do things in a new manner. So coachability for me is an athlete's willingness to accept what the new norms are, the new standards, new expectations, and adapt to those, to attempt to acquire them and develop them and build new habits. Athleticism is the actual ability to change, but coachability is the willingness to engage in the process and persist and believe that making the change is valuable. So that's a very, very big part of what we do with everyone that comes in as a first-year student at the university at Thoreau, and everyone who comes into the training center. They experience that same thing. Very, very often it takes just a conversation. It takes a real simple sit-down conversation to sort of explain where you are, that you're coming from, and how we need you to change, and why we need you to change. And then the light goes off. But if you're just out on the lake barking at them, asking them to do something differently, and they don't have sort of the intellectual background or the gut understanding of why this change is valuable, it can be a terribly, terribly long process. So that coachability is huge. It's absolutely huge.
Fantastic advice for coaches. So have the conversation off the water with the athlete one-on-one.
Yes. Yes. All conversations occur off the water. If you're on the water, you cannot have a productive, lengthy conversation. You just can't. The athlete's in the boat. They're thinking about other things. They're getting cold or they're getting hot. Their time is limited. You're by nature yelling at them in all likelihood because you're at some distance. A substantive conversation needs to happen on land. The explanation happens on land. The correction and the reminders happen on the water.
Great advice. In fact, we have an ebook in our store which was originally written for coxswains, but in fact it applies to everyone. It's called Having Difficult Conversations. And has some sound advice in there. Now, let's move on to a little bit on strength training. So Flavia DeLucas, who is from the Feather River Rowing Club in Oroville, has asked, what kind of strength training is most efficient for lightweights?
Yeah, efficiency is key when you're dealing with busy people, whether they're students or club rowers with jobs. I would say the most efficient weight training is going to be body weight activity. It's going to be exercises that involve lifting and moving your body weight. And I think there's a misperception in the part of some places that you need a fancy weight room, you need all the latest gadgets and gizmos. But the truth is, simple activities involving the lifting and moving of one's own body weight can develop a great deal of strength. And in terms of the efficiency, it can be done in a very short period of time, no breakdown, no setup, no need to get to a facility. So I would say body weight activities are by far the most efficient.
Give us some examples.
The simplest things, you don't see them done all that much, but something as simple as jumpies, just jumping off the ground, lowering your rear end till it's level with your knees and springing up into the air as high as you can go and doing that repeatedly, you will absolutely develop very good leg strength, very good dynamic, explosive power. And again, you don't need a single tool for that. Pull-ups is the simplest way to develop your upper body strength. If you're not able to do pull-ups, doing flex arm hangs, very simple ways. Abdominal work with sit-ups and leg raises and whatnot. Back work, just being on your stomach and doing some flying eagles there are any number of very simple things that one can do with your body, your own body weight. And, again, I do think that's the most efficient way to build strength, usable strength, sport-specific strength even. You know, the other, of course, would be just row hard. You know, we the reality of it is the ergometer is a fabulous strength tool. You don't need to set the drag factor terribly high. I'm not recommending that. But just take, you know, warm up, build into it, and take 10 strokes as hard as you possibly can at a relatively low rate on the ergometer, and you're going to develop the sport-specific strength. And again, I'm confident that every rower that might be listening to us has access to an ergometer.
That's fantastic advice. So thank you for that. And now we're going to go back to a topic that you mentioned earlier about March being the transition month, because we have a question in from Lillian Page, who's in Ottawa at the Ottawa Rowing Club, and she classes her level of experience as expert. And she asks, regarding weightlifting, what type of program would you recommend for an experienced lightweight woman who's trying to cut weight after a productive winter season of heavy lifting while still maintaining her strength?
Well, if you're trying to cut weight, you're probably going to need to substitute some of those lifting sessions with some more endurance-oriented cardiovascular sessions. So I would scale back on the amount of time that you're spending with your weightlifting. You know, two sessions a week is absolutely plenty in season to maintain strength, and just take the remainder of that time and put it into you know, additional cardiovascular and endurance-based activities to help you make that move down to your racing weight.
Fantastic. And of course, Leanne, of course, you can do some of the things that Bill was talking earlier about, the body weight training. Now, we've touched on the erg. What particularly on the erg should lightweights be working on?
I honestly, maybe this will be a bit of a theme for this conversation, but I don't see anything lightweight specific on the ergometer. You know, the work that one does on the ergometer, to me, would be fairly consistent, again, whether you're a heavyweight male, lightweight male, open weight woman, lightweight woman. You know, it there may be a need to, you know, burn a few more calories and just put in a little bit more time on that weight management, and the erg can be used for that. You may use the erg specifically to, you know, sweat down before a weigh-in. But in terms of one's general training, I don't see the need to do anything differently because you're a lightweight. Now, I'll throw in the caveat that I think all athletes should be very aware and cognizant of what the drag factor is when they're doing work. I don't think that's particular to lightweights, but I don't also think that that's as commonly, that people don't pay attention to that as much as I think they should. So, you know, you want to know what your drag factor is and make sure you're not rowing too heavy for too long.
Tell me, what are the numbers you're looking for?
Well, it depends on the speed of the boat. You know, it depends a lot on the speed of the boat. But I would suggest that, you know, sort of with the athletes that I'm working with, you know, we're not going to go north of 130. You know, we're going to do a lot of work in the 115 range, 120 range, and that's you know, there is a miss with younger athletes in particular. There's a real misperception that, you know, the harder it is, the better it is, and you know, that's not true. I've been able to show a few that you can make it mighty mighty hard with a lighter drag. you know, again, it does depend on the speed of the boat that you're training for, and it does depend to a degree on you know, the rate that you plan on using and the duration of the work that you're doing. I would say to most people that if you're going to err on the lighter side.
So, as a rule of thumb, the bigger the boat, the heavier the drag factor. Is that correct?
Actually, just the inverse. So the bigger the boat, the faster the boat, the lighter the strokes are on the water, and thus to replicate that, you'd want to go with a lighter drag factor. So if you're training for an eight or a quad, you're really incentivized to learn how to spin that wheel and produce the sort of splits that you're looking for with a lighter drag factor. If you're preparing for the pair or the single, then you might want to do some work with a more moderate drag factor to simulate the fact that the drive is slower in those boats.
So we talked about Harry Mahon earlier, and I was fortunate to be his flatmate for a while. And I saw him do a fabulous session when he was coaching at Cambridge University. And he had the athletes on row perfects, and he had made up plastic bags to go over the flywheel, which basically meant no drag factor or very little. And this was how he had them working on the catch, because he wanted.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So, well, I will put a garbage bag over a concept too, and it's just a way to teach people how to just jack the rate up and what it means to just really get it going. But that's a brilliant idea. You know, the lighter the load, the more challenging it is to get hold of the work, and that sort of exaggeration, that's typical of what I know of what he did, and sort of the brilliance of his coaching and thinking to come up with that. That's an outstanding idea. That's an outstanding idea. I would encourage athletes to progress towards that. We always say, the easiest way to learn is to make it heavy. To start heavy. Start with a heavy load. It's easier to feel. It's easier to engage. The athlete is much, much more likely to be aware of what their body is experiencing. And then get the behavior you're looking for with a heavy load, and then progressively lighten the load and try to have the athlete continue to feel the same resistance, the same sequencing that he or she did when it was heaviest. And so Harry's taken it all the way to the extreme end of the spectrum, and no surprise. He would think outside the box, and he would come up with a great idea like that.
Yeah, I think he had them chasing the same numbers that they were able to pull without the bags. So yeah. That's
a challenge. Chasing being the operative word there, I suspect.
Now, quick question from me. Do you do weight-adjusted ergs? So when you take their scores, do you then net it back against the athlete weight?
Yes and no. A very unsatisfactory answer. It depends. What we will do with our university students, and you'll see this at the national level too, less frequently, is we'll be weight conscious. So if we're going to do an ergometer that is really designed to measure their performance as opposed to just train, we'll ask them to get on the scale so that we have an idea of what they're weighing. We will not plug in a formula necessarily and rank people or anything like that. But it's important in a sport where you have averaging in team boats, averaging of weight, to keep that in mind, keep someone's weight in mind when you're evaluating what they're doing on the ergometer, for sure. I tend to think that the way I like to do it is I like to have a real good idea of basically how many watts per kilo, what they're generating, what kind of energy is being generated per kilo of body mass. I think the sort of the true measure is probably half weight adjusted and half straight. Somewhere in the middle of those two is probably the best indicator of someone's physiological capacity on the water.
That's a great answer. Thank you for that. No. I was going to take a small message from our sponsor.
Yeah.
Rowing Chat this week is sponsored by strength coach Will. Owned by Will Ruth, he is the author of Rowing Stronger, the book and DVD, which will teach you what you need to incorporate strength and conditioning training into your program. Will's careful explanations and video give you confidence to do the exercises and lifts correctly. He also shares a training program which you can adapt to your needs in your season. There are chapters for masters, for juniors, and for lightweights. Get yourself strong for rowing with strength coach Will Ruth. You can buy the book and DVD together. Go to rowperfect.co.uk/shop and search for bundles in the left-hand side menu. Will Ruth is also running a Strength Coach Roundtable podcast as part of the Rowing Chat series. So watch out for that. We'll be advertising it on the blog, on social media. But if you're on our newsletter list, you'll be sure to get a mention. Now, back to Bill. Bill, one of the things that I'm always keen to ask about is how athletes who are in a lightweight program should adapt their weight while they're in training. I know, for example, the Great British National Team require men to be at or around 70 kgs throughout the training season. They don't want them much heavier and then having to go lighter. So what's your approach to weight management within training?
Well, it does depend a bit on the group that I'm working with. Most of my time is spent with university students, and we take a very different approach from GB in that regard. Our academic year begins in September. Our most important racing is in May and early June. So for the first term of school from September through January, we actually, we do not have the students get on the scale at all. Now, we do participate in one or two races, the Head of the Charles, the Princeton Chase, where they do have a max weight of 165. They weigh in the day before for that. So if they're going to enter those events, then yeah, they do get on the scale for them. But as coaches, we are not actively monitoring their weight on a regular basis during the first term of school. They know where they need to be in the second term, and they know that they can't get too far away from that without making life really difficult for themselves. So there's clearly some self-policing that goes on. But the truth is, we want them to be bigger while they're training. We want them to be comfortable. We want rowing on the lightweight team at Princeton to be enjoyable, not a year-long sacrifice. And so we don't begin asking them to step on the scale until the second term begins in February. And at that point, every single student has met with a dietitian, they've done some body composition analysis and whatnot, and we introduce the concept of target weight, sort of the weight that they need to be. The way it works in university rowing in the States, they weigh in the day before. So the weight they need to be the day before the race when they step on the scale. And our first weigh-in in February will be what we call a plus 10 weigh-in, where they're, we do things in pounds. So it's 10 pounds heavier than their target weight, a little over 4 kilos. And then we just gradually bring them down. And that allows them to come down to weight in a safe manner. It allows us as coaches to keep an eye on them and make sure that they're behaving correctly and not doing things in a way that is not good for their overall health. And it also gives them a couple of practice weigh-ins so that they can practice the very important recovery aspect. So one of the things that, as we talk about weight with us, we always also talk about performance. So when we weigh, if we're doing a weigh-in, we're also doing a performance-based workout the following day. If we were doing this at international standards, we'd do the weigh-in 2 hours before and then do a performance-based workout. So in other words, getting to weight is half the challenge. Performing, competing capably and with all your resources when called upon at weight, is what really matters. And so we really try to tie in together that they need to do both. And that then means learning how to recover, how to replenish, how to restock and be ready to go again at the university level for the racing the next day. But we really only want them at weight that moment that they're stepping on the scale. We don't want them at that weight at all, other than for that brief moment.
Talk us through what your recovery and replenishment strategies are.
Highly individualistic. This is the classic, you can lead the horse to water kind of story. You educate, you talk about the importance of replacing glycogen and sodium and electrolytes and you show them the right sorts of things to refuel with and replenish with. And inevitably one of your best kids still shows up with a bag from the convenience store full of junk. What we would like to see them doing is immediately getting easily digestible food into their system, getting their hydration level back up. Because at the university level here, we weigh in the day before the event. There is some significant dehydration that occurs. It's common for students to dehydrate 5% of their body weight with a weigh in the day before the contest. So getting those fluids back into their system and getting those fluids absorbed by their body is absolutely vital. There's nothing that we're doing that's unique. It's all in the literature. You can read the label on your bottle of Gatorade or your Powerade, and you can find most of what you need to know. We're just trying to get them to do things, to do it without candy and treats. We don't want them to see food as a reward. We want them to see food as a fuel for performance. And that does, sometimes that takes a little educating. By the time the international athletes have been at it, they have their system down. Again, at that point, you still see some behaviors that you might not think are optimal, you've learned that people find ways that work for them. And if they believe it works for them, let them do it. Do not interfere with that unless there's a performance problem.
So eating piles of boiled sweets the day before. I knew a man who used to do that. Legendary. Hey, ho. Now, you talked earlier about the concept of target weights, and let's talk about a crew boat, a four or an eight. As a coach, and you have a squad of athletes who are in all shapes and sizes, explain how you set target weights and then allocate them individually.
Yeah, the target weights are something that you come to having observed your athletes over a long period of time. And the target weights are they're targets. They're not hard and fast. In our university system, we're now racing most Saturdays. And this is early in the season for us. We're changing lineups weekly, if not daily. So the students know that the target weights are fluid. We want them to have an idea of where they need to be through the winter months. But once we get into racing season, they know that they may be able to weigh in a little bit heavier on one week. They may need to weigh in a little bit lighter on another week, depending upon what crew they're in and who else is in that crew with them. My experience has been that when they feel the boat's going well, the athletes will do amazing things to make that average work for the crew as a whole. And that's obviously, you hope to create an environment where everybody feels good, that the sacrifices they're making are being shared by their teammates, and that it's leading everyone towards greater success on the water. The target weight is also, I kind of deviated from your question, but the target weight is also determined partially by their meeting with a dietitian, who does look at their body composition and does do some professional analysis that is, more professional than what the rowing coach, him or herself, may be able to provide. So we rely on that a lot. There's nothing more important to being a lightweight than the athlete wanting to be a lightweight. People can do some very extreme things. And if they're older and they're not minors, they can make those choices of their own, but they can do some pretty extreme things when they're motivated to. Part of our responsibility is to make the rowing enjoyable enough that they're motivated to do what they want to do and can do.
So you've touched on psychology several times here, yeah. And it's becoming increasingly clear that what happens between your ears is a significant contributor to ultimate outcomes.
Yes, it is. Everything's important because you can't be successful without all of the pieces. So I don't worry about trying to assign a certain percentage to, it comes down to this amount of physiology and this amount of psychology and this amount of technique. And because the reality of it is you can't be successful on race day without putting all of those things together. So to prioritize them or put them in a hierarchy is highly misleading. You've just got to look for the best gains you can make in every category. And the psychological side is certainly, I think the longer you are involved in the sport, the more evident or the stronger your interest probably is in that. And I think that's true partly as we age, we just become more in tune with that. Whereas a youngster is really captivated more often by just, you know, seeing their splits drop and seeing themselves get stronger and fitter. And I think more mature athletes find that the psychological gains, that becomes a bit more fascinating than just the training.
So moving forward, what's your ideal lightweight as a coach? What are you looking for?
The question leads you to think just about their physical characteristics, of course. And, so physically you're looking for someone who's got, you know, long levers, who's tall, who's lean, who's got a great aerobic capacity and explosive strength. And, but the reality of it is we don't get to choose, you know, for the most part as a coach, you're subject to what comes through the door, what the intake is, and you get to work with what comes to you. And I think, as an athlete, as a master's athlete, for instance, it really doesn't matter what the ideal is. It only matters what you are. So, learning to work with the available resources is much, much more important and compelling than trying to design or seek out the prototypical ideal lightweight. And I also think, the most important qualities are still the ones that are not visible to anyone else. You can't look and see how motivated someone is. You know, you can't look and see at a physiological level, you can't look and see what their aerobic capacity is. You have no idea. People can appear very muscular, but that doesn't mean they're particularly strong. What matters is giving people opportunity and putting them in situations where they're challenged and seeing how they perform, seeing who rises to the occasion, who has that coachability, who's willing to alter their behavior to pursue a goal. The short answer, I just gave you the long answer. The short answer is, the ideal lightweight is the one who really wants to do it.
Fantastic. Now, every athlete through their career has goals that they want to achieve. There might be teams they want to get into. There might be crews they want to get into. They might want to go for national selection. What advice do you give someone who has found a goal? How do they go about achieving that?
Well,
how to get selected?
And whatever. one step at a time. I think that I think to have goals is necessary. It's beneficial to articulate the goal. I really encourage athletes to share their goals with others because I find that it's really helpful for the people around you to be aware of what you're trying to do, and it also makes it more important for you. People will contribute to your journey if they're aware that it's important to you. So saying that I want to be in a crew that defeats the opposite, our big opponent this year. I want to make the squad this upcoming summer, I think that's really powerful when you articulate it and share it with those around you, the people that are important to you. So I encourage people to do that for sure. I making sure that they have intermediate and short-term goals, so that it's a journey and you take it one step at a time. You know, what can you do today that's going to further you along that journey? Where do you want to be at the end of this month that's going to get you closer to where you want to be eventually? What road markers do you have that will help you gauge whether or not you are progressing? So that if you're not, you can adjust. And if you are, you can take further confidence in that and be inspired by that. I think rowing without goals is somewhat art. It's more of an art. Rowing with goals is competition. And I think one of the great things about rowing is that you can be someone who engages in it just at the sort of artistic love of nature, being out on the water and feeling the boat underneath you level. And you can also be someone who approaches it as an avenue to channel your competitive energies. Not every sport allows you to do both.
Very true. One of the wonderful things about rowing. So there's another little ebook that I'm going to throw in at this stage, which is called Get Fast Fast, A Project Management Approach to Lightweight Rowing. And this is the story of a university athlete in the US who had determined that his erg score was a limiting factor to what he wanted to achieve. And he just tells the story of how he went about it. And that might give some people inspiration toward achieving their goals, their process goals, particularly as you mentioned, Ben. Now I've got two slightly quick questions, which I'm going to throw in at the same time. We've got Penelope Green and Debbie Jackson, one from Vashon. And another from Minneapolis. And one says training tips for older lightweight women, and the other says any suggestions for masters lightweight. So I'm guessing they're both masters.
Yeah.
Where would you send them off?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of masters, you know, as we age, we tend to lose strength more than we lose our endurance quality. So I think the older the athlete, the more they need to be attentive to trying to maintain their strength. You know, making sure that you're doing something hard, something physically hard, that involves a heavy load, that, is going to allow you to, you know, keep the muscles and the bones, strong and functioning. You know, the truth is also that, you know, that it's hard as in it's difficult, and it's hard as in it's uncomfortable. And so it tends to be what gets cut out of a program. When you're not part of a group and being supervised. So if you're a master's rower and you're sort of training and you're single, or you're on your own in some capacity, you know, just being willing to hold yourself accountable for getting one or two of those really tough, demanding, heavy workload bouts of exercise in, hitting the weights hard or doing those power strokes on the water. I think that's something that is unique as you get older. You've got to attend to that. And I would say conversely, you know, the truth be told, if you've been rowing for quite a long time, you're probably not going to make technical gains that are going to have a big impact. You've probably really grooved in your rowing or sculling, and you know, so expecting that you're going to find a lot of boat speed by changing how you row or how you scull. If you've been doing the sport for a long time and you're a master's, that might not be the area where you're going to experience the greatest chance of increasing your speed. So, but on the other hand, if you can do more physically relative to your peers, you have a chance there to really step up and separate yourself and distinguish yourself.
Fabulous. Of course, in the US, you have lightweight events for masters, and I think that's unique in the world. So now on to technique. Goodness me, I can't believe we're nearly done and haven't gotten around to the question about technique. But Rob Canavan's the man who's thrown this one out. He asks, how do you teach the approach to the catch? He said, everyone knows not to lunge the upper body into the stern, but what should the rowers feel in the legs as they roll up the slide?
Ooh, nothing specific to lightweights, you know, in the rowing stroke, everything occurs before it happens. So if you're, you know, the wording of that question, I think, shows a real understanding of the stroke, that if you want to have a good catch or a good entry, whichever word you prefer, it really comes down to how you've taken the recovery and how you've prepared yourself for that. So I'd like to think that you, in your legs, you should feel a connection to the foot stretchers, particularly through the second half of the recovery. The first half of the recovery, I'd really want the individual to feel their body weight on their feet, connected to the foot stretchers, that they're sitting up, they've pivoted over. Some of the weight has come off of their seat and has been transferred to their feet. And then, you know, feel a firmer, more solid connection to the foot stretchers, and to feel, you know, feel that through the legs, feel that, if you want the word, tension. But, you know, that's your potential energy that you're going to then expand, you know, when that blade locks in and you drive the boat. So you've got to feel that you're connected to what it is you're going to be pushing against before you try to push. If you don't have that sense of engagement with the foot stretchers before you try to move the boat, before you try to drive the legs, well, then, you know, you're going to be kicking, and you're going to inevitably push the boat in the wrong direction before you begin to move it in the direction forward, in the direction that you want to go. So feel it. You know, a good analogy I always heard is it's sort of the difference. You can, it's like, imagine you're holding a tube of toothpaste, and, you know, you're going to hold it, and that's the recovery. And then, you know, the drive is you're going to squeeze the toothpaste out of the tube. But you wouldn't go up and just snatch the tube of toothpaste out of the air. If you were trying to put some on your toothbrush, you would have hold of it. You would be connected to it. You would be ready to squeeze. And, that's going to minimize the push of the boat in the opposite direction if you do that.
Fantastic. Now back into the weight room again for James Healy, who's from Kenmare Rowing and Boat Club. And he asks, how many weight sessions a week do your lightweights do, and what percentage of their maximum would they be lifting during these exercises? He says, taking into consideration that you don't want to gain too much weight, of course.
Yeah. I, you know, two a week throughout the year. As we get into racing season, one a week. You know, as far as percentage of max, I would say for the it depends on the time of the year. I don't have a straight answer for you on that, because it really does. We're not doing much weightlifting right now, other than maintenance work and you know, a couple of heavy lifts. You know, even just the body weight activity that I described earlier can be very sufficient for maintaining that strength. You know, building power is going to make the boat faster. It's going to make your contributions to the boat more significant, and making sure that you don't lose power when you come down to weight is one of the surest ways of ensuring that you make the boat go fast as a lightweight.
So as a corollary to that, are there any things coaches can watch out for injury prevention in their athletes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I talked earlier about, with the lightweights in particular, when they are close to their weight, and if they've been working to get their weight down, just being careful on with heavy loads into the wind when you're on the water, particularly sustained heavy loads. I think one of the things that you can do is really just try to encourage a athleticism. There's so much talk right now about core strength and core stability, and it's all valuable. But you know, back when our kids were playing various games at different times of year and doing different sports year round, we didn't talk too much about that, because they were acquiring that through a variety of activities. And now, as we've gotten into greater and greater specialization, we've had to isolate those activities in order to keep people healthy, or try to keep people healthy. So I think one of the things that you can do is just encourage general athleticism. Get people moving around. You know, don't be afraid to engage in other activities. Make other activities part of your training. I do not suggest going out and playing rugby the week of your championships if you haven't played rugby all year round. But you don't have to do everything on the erg in the boat, you know, particularly with younger athletes. So I think that's really one of the best ways to try to keep people healthy is to keep them active in various athletic activities, not just rowing.
Fantastic, thank you. Now my last question to you is, if you could change any one thing about the sport of rowing, what would it be?
Oh, I'd want my boats to be faster. I would like to see the participation in rowing continue to grow. And here in the U.S., our system is you know, we have an amazing university system over here for rowing, for frankly most sports. But even now, I think we could do a better job of introducing the sport to people that had not been exposed to it in school or as youngsters. And I think that would be a real strength in our country if we continued to promote and look for ways to provide an entry point for people. You know, with that would include sort of what might be called non-traditional populations, people that haven't gone to haven't traditionally gone to the best known universities or the wealthiest universities. So there's an amazing amount of human capital in this country and in other countries. And if rowing can make itself more accessible, I think the caliber of rowing and the competitiveness of rowing across the globe will only increase.
So does Row America contribute to that?
That's certainly one thing. Yeah, absolutely.
They look like an amazing organization. I'm sorry to say I've only become aware of them in recent years.
Yeah. Well, that's, when people like Howard Winklevoss get behind things, they happen. And, to have him interested in promoting the sport and getting the sport into new communities, that's only good for us. That's a good thing.
Yeah. Fantastic. Bill, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. Can you let our listeners know where they can connect with you?
Sure. The easiest is, email. My email address is very simple. My initials, WM for William Manning, and then the digit 7, so WM7@Princeton.edu. WM7@Princeton.edu. Happy to hear from anybody, and I'll take criticisms as easily as I'll take compliments, so send them along.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you. And we welcome all comments and suggestions for new episodes of Rowing Chat, or if you've got further questions from this episode, you can send it to info@rowperfect.co.uk. Past episodes are available at rowperfect.co.uk/rowingchat, and you can follow us on Twitter @rowperfect or Facebook Rowperfect UK. Please subscribe to our feed in iTunes, SoundCloud, or YouTube. Just search for Rowing Chat. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share this with your club mates, which will help other rowers get more enjoyment from their rowing. For more information about Row Perfect UK and its educational services for coaches, coxswains, and athletes, go to rowperfect.co.uk. See you next month.